Hello, and welcome to Saver, a production of iHeartRadio. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and today we're talking about scallions.
And other things related.
Well, yes, it's a category of stuff that goes under a variety of names. Here yes. In the States, green onions is the other thing that they're most frequently called, but we'll get into all of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it made for some fun times in research. And what else made for some fun times in research is, perhaps obviously, we're not talking about the Booker T and MG song, which is what all of my results were when I first started Googling green onions. So, this is a song, according to legend, was so named because the band wanted something as funky as possible for the name. And the original name was Funky Onions. Makes sense. But it sounded too close to a curse word in a Southern accent. So they went with green onions.
Instead of, right, yes. Yeah, yeah. Funk particularly was the word that was in question.
Yes, not onions.
Not onions, no.
Right. But yeah, that dominated my research results. I've been getting a lot of green onions lately and leeks, which got me confused because I've always labored under the misconception that they were just big green onions.
Okay. Again, the nomenclature is complicated, but they're similar.
They are similar, yes. And I love green onions. I grew up in a household where they were around all the time. And also in my house, we called them interchangeably scallions, green onions, or spring onions. So probably throughout this episode, I'm going to try to stick to one, but I'll probably bounce around. And my dad particularly loved them. He would eat them straight, sort of like Bugs Bunny with a carrot. I would just see him snacking on some green onions.
Sure, why not? Yeah. In my household growing up, my dad called them scallions. And so that tends to be the word that I tend to use for them.
Yeah, I am growing some, and it's going swimmingly currently. I have a bit of a fear that it's just going to randomly die because that's what happens to me a lot. But apparently, growing some in a jar is a quarantine trend. I am not the only person doing this.
Right. And when you say growing them, you're not saying that you started with the seed and you're growing them from scratch. You're saying that yes. You cut the green tops off of some scallions and put the rooty bits in a jar with some water, and then they've got shoots coming up again. Yeah.
Yeah, and so fast, so fast.
Yeah. That is an easy and delightful thing to do. Longtime listeners may remember that I shouldn't really eat anything in the onion family. It gives me digestive problems. Or not problem. Sure, let's call it problems. Anyway. I kind of try to avoid them in general. They're a delightful thing.
Oh yeah. I absolutely adore them. And speaking of, we have done a whole episode on onion before, which serves really well to explain what, especially for like history and, well, I guess pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of the same. They're very similar. which I guess brings us to our question. Scallions / green onions / a million other names. What are they?
Well, scallions are types of onion that do not develop the big, fleshy bulb underground. Instead, the green shoots that pop up above ground are what we mostly use. I mean, like, you can eat the underground white bit, too. It'll just never develop to be really much wider around than the shoots. You see, when onions grow, they shoot up these tall, cylindrical tubes of concentric leaves that sort of look like a single stem, but they're just a tightly packed bundle of leaves. And using the sunlight that they take in from those leaves, plus the water that they get from their true roots, onions will develop a storage root underground where they build up water and sugars and other nutrients and defensive chemicals so that the plant can survive through the winter and then shoot up a flower in the spring. And each layer of that underground root will try to sprout up a layer of leaf within the leaf tube. Okay?
Okay.
So in regular onions that grow those thick, juicy bulbs, those leaves also tend to be thick and kind of juicy. In scallions, though, the thin bulbs put off these thin leaves, sometimes paper thin, and sometimes just a single layer or two of leaf. The whole plant tends to be more mild, like less sharp tasting and sulfury than other onions, which lets these other notes come through. They're more grassy and earthy and bright. You often chop fresh scallion leaves to use as a delicate garnish or like a last minute add-in to dishes to just give it a little bit of a pop. And there are a few species and varieties of onions that get lumped into this category, all in the Allium genus. Varieties of Allium sepa, which is the common onion, plus species like Allium chinesi, I hate Latin, I'm sorry, Allium fistulosum and Allium proliferum. And all of these have slightly different leaves and roots and flavors, but all are especially prized for those thinner and milder leaf shoots. But this brings us to our secondary question.
Yes, green onions versus scallions. Are they the same?
Yep, they are. Yep, green onion is another term for scallion.
Okay, but what about spring onions?
Well, in the United States, spring onion is a term for a slightly different thing that's used in a similar way. It's the leaves of onions that you harvest in the spring when those leaves pop up from the grown, overwintered storage root. So they're stronger in flavor than scallions, usually.
Oh, wait. Are you saying in some countries they go by opposite names?
Yep. Throughout most of the rest of the English-speaking world, you might use spring onion to refer to scallions and green onion to refer to the shoots of onions that come up in the springtime.
Oh, no.
Language, it's so fun.
Oh, fun is one word for it, especially as a podcaster and food researcher.
And that goes double when with a product like this, there are even more other names that the same thing can be referred to as.
Yes. For instance, some types of scallion are also sometimes called the Welsh onion, not because they're from Wales.
Nope.
No. But because of the old German word Welsh, which meant foreign.
And that's because one of those species I mentioned, A. fistulosum, is native to East and Southeast Asia. And that's usually what you're talking about if someone in an English-speaking country refers to something as a Welsh onion, that it was imported from, China. Or et cetera. Sometimes they're also called salad onions, or you might have heard the term bunching onion used. And bunching onion, salad onions is because you might slice them up and put them in a salad. Easy. Bunching onions is because a lot of types of these onion grow their small bulbs and their shoots in bunches or bundles of these connected true root systems. Like regular onions will grow multiple bulbs from the same root, but not in the big clusters that you get from scallion-type onions.
Oh, okay. Well, this is part of the reason I had a massive gardening failure weeks ago. Because I'm used to seeing them like this. And apparently, I've never really taken in what garlic looks like when it comes fresh. So
oh,
I thought
okay.
The garlic was, we're bunching scallions, bunching onions. And I tried to grow that in a jar of water. And I anyone who's listening, for the love of God, don't try to do that. Because the smell was so bad. There were tears. There was dry heaving.
Oh.
Only later did I realize my fatal gardening mistake.
Oh,
and I won't soon make it again.
I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, you can, like, if a clove of garlic within a bulb has sprouted a little green shoot, you can, I'm not sure if you can water plant it, but you can definitely, like, stick it in soil and try to grow a new garlic plant from that.
Yeah.
But
the method I tried, yeah.
But I wouldn't recommend, because the thing about garlic bulbs is that they come to you dried. So the little rooty bits that are down at the bottom of the mm-hmm. bunch are not living anymore. They're not gonna grow. They're just gonna
ferment
essentially like ferment. Yes. Rot. Rot in some way and not yes. be pleasant. Oh, I'm sorry, dude.
It's okay. I, you know, the more you know, I'm learning, growing, unlike my garlic. But we're not done. We are not done with our name and etymology mayhem.
We are not. Okay, so the word scallion itself comes from Ascalon or Ashkelon, which is this ancient seaport located in modern-day Israel. So ancient Greeks and Romans were basically calling this type of plant onions from this seaport, Ascalon. And the name developed over time from that.
Oh. Also, the Irish family name scallion, which is amazing, by the way, goes way back. It's an English translation of a Gaelic name meaning student. Some records shorten the name to Scully, O'Scully, or Scally. I love Scally. That's excellent, too. That's great.
That is great. I wonder if that's where the surname Scully is in, like, Agent Scully, mm-hmm. like from X-Files,
yeah.
comes from. I could not, although, figure out how far back this name goes, but it makes me wonder whether the name and the food popped up in the area around the same time. The food term entered English around the 13 or 1400s. So I would have to get into a type of research that I'm not used to doing in order to get into that. But I did go on another tangent for the word rapscallion to see whether it was from the same root. And it's not. That descends from the word rascal, which seems to come from the word rash, as in, like, quick, which may root from Latin or vulgar Latin verbs for scrape, rasis or rassicare. Anyway, we're a food show.
Purportedly.
Hypothetically, yeah.
I had forgotten about rapscallion. That's fun, too.
Oh, it is. And another thing that I found out while I was researching this is that there was a feminine version of rapscallion, which originally had a very male connotation, rampallion, which came from an old usage of the word ramp to mean like a scandalous lady or ill-behaved woman.
Oh, oh dear.
I know, right? Also a different root from the onion type ramps.
Oh, wow. So much confusion when it comes to names in this one.
I'm pretty sure I didn't actually look into it. We'll have to do a whole episode on ramps at some point as well.
Yes.
But, okay, coming back to scallions.
Yes. They are used in all kinds of things. As a topping, frequently paired with potatoes and stir fries and savory pancakes, grilled or roasted whole, in champ, which is an Irish potato dish. Here in the South, they are sometimes obviously cooked in cream. And as a part of a Catalan feast called calçotada. Okay, I am in love with this. I'm in love with this. So this is grilled green onions dipped in Romanesco sauce, supplemented by lots and lots of wine, most likely red wine, drunk from a porron, which is sort of a teapot for wine where people drink out of the stem. pass it from person to person.
Okay.
Some accounts I read, you can tell how seasoned someone is by how far away they hold it to drink the wine,
which I love.
And if you're worried about how messy this sounds, bibs are a part of it. People wear bibs. Please write in. Please. And if you're still a little confused, calsots are a variety of scallion that are grown covered by dirt to keep the white parts nice and tender, just like white asparagus.
Okay.
And we'll go into the history very briefly of why in the history section. At this festival, freshly grilled calsots are wrapped in newspaper. And from some things I read, a single portion is 20 calsots.
Wow. Oh, I wonder exactly how thick they are. Because there are certainly dishes where you like grill or roast these things whole, right? But that's delicious.
I know. Oh, we'll have to add it to our food field trip list, which is growing atrociously long.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, apparently I read that you can pickle them and it's good.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, you can pickle anything and it'll be pretty good. But no, pickled onions are delicious. Absolutely.
Oh, all right. New project.
Mm-hmm.
Also, as a garnish, I read something else. Again, please write in if you've done this. People make this sort of scallion brush by you cut vertical, thinly sliced vertical cuts along the white and green ends, or alternatively, just one side. And then you leave a part in the center that's uncut. And then you place that in cold water and refrigerate it for at least an hour and up to overnight. And then these cuts will curl and form frilly ends like a brush.
Yeah, chilling cut scallions in cold water is altogether a great way to firm them up because they'll soak in some of that water, thus like plumping their cell walls and making them more crisp. And that process will also take some of the sharp edge off and make them a little bit curly as they plump. Yeah. And that brush technique is used specifically in Chinese and related cuisines as a pretty way to serve sauces. Like a dish of sauce might be served with a scallion brush so that every diner can use that brush to apply the sauce to their food. This is seen often in like Peking duck and other dishes like that.
Oh, I love it. All right.
Mm-hmm.
What about the nutrition?
Scallions are super low in fats and calories overall. They're you know, mostly water and dietary fiber, with a smattering of vitamins and minerals, especially vitamin K. So they are a really great way to add flavor and vitamins to dishes without adding a whole bunch of extra calories. You're usually not eating enough scallions to, like, really get a serious nutritive value. But if you do, they do also have a decent little punch of protein to them, as many leafy greens will. So they will help fill you up, but you know, pair them with fats and proteins to help keep you going.
Yeah. I've been using them a lot ever since we did our eggplant episode. I'm on a real eggplant kick.
Ooh, Yeah.
And I've been using them atop eggplant dishes a lot lately.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so good.
Good times.
Great times. When it comes to numbers, it is hard to separate scallion / green onion production / whatever you particularly call them and onion at large production. But China is the largest producer of onions, so it stands to reason that they're the largest producer of green onions, too. In the United States, the top producer of green onions is California. One report claimed that fresh green onions are the fastest growing segment in the onion market.
I've seen that too. South Carolina is also a major grower here in the U.S., though a lot of the scallions that we do eat in the States come from Mexico, which has had a kind of rough time of summer weather the past few years, so their crops have been declining just a little bit because climate change is terrible.
Yeah. Over at Serious Eats, Jay Kenji Lopez-Alt semi-jokingly suggested that scallion pancakes are the most consumed laminated pastry in the world, surpassing the croissant. And it was a very delightful article about how to make them, very in-depth as usual. So go check that out if you're interested.
Oh, always check out Serious Eats and specifically his articles. But But yeah, so we do, despite all of this confusion, have some history for you. But first, we've got a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with a brief Onion history refresher, which is essentially the history of green spring salad, Welsh onions, scallions, whatever you call them. And written records are very scarce around them specifically. So just a little refresher and some bonus leak facts.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. Onions have been around for a long, 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 long time. They were probably eaten wild as a staple in prehistoric diet of humans. Most historians think that onions originated in Asia or perhaps what is modern day Pakistan or Iran. Since wild onions grew all over, they were probably domesticated around the world simultaneously in a bunch of different places around the same time. They most likely were one of the first domesticated crops, and they were a hugely important crop as food, mm-hmm. as art, as medicine, spiritually, and in mummification, all kinds of things. Green onions and leeks go back at least 5,000 years, most likely originally hailing from the Mediterranean or Asia, but all that stuff we said about onions, you could kind of put in there too. Mm-hmm. The word for leek comes from the old English word for lace. Leeks were cultivated in ancient Egypt, and they were possibly used there as currency, and some Egyptian tombs were adorned with images of leeks.
Hmm.
Stories tell that Emperor Nero loved leeks, believing that they could improve his singing voice. Allegedly, he liked them enough that people called him Leek Eater. Yeesh.
I mean, all right.
Good? Bad?
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess it depends on the tone.
Neutral. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. Oh, that leek eater. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the breath could be bad.
It could.
Admittedly. Yes. Meanwhile, Apicius wrote of a recipe of fried green onions, salt, pork, vinegar, and honey, which sounds delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Theophrastus mentioned the green onion, and some attribute the name scallion to him in ancient Greek. He also wrote that the best leeks came from Egypt and that they were delicious enough to be eaten on their own. Scallions were mentioned in the Bible, and for some are still a part of Passover as whipping scallions. They were used medicinally. All these things we're talking about were used medicinally. Leeks, scallions, green onions, spring onions, for all kinds of things, including, particularly during the Middle Ages, an aphrodisiac. They had a really fun name for them specifically, but I can't remember. It was just like a more romantic term for aphrodisiac. Oh, you're not fooling us. champ, which is that Irish dish we mentioned earlier, traditionally consisting of a creamy mash of potatoes, scallions, milk, and or cream and butter, became popular in Ireland during times of hardship, famine, and unrest. Potatoes were an Irish staple by the 1800s. Again, the dates around this were very, very murky, but I've never had this and it sounds delicious. I'm super into it. The leek is one of the national emblems of Wales.
Mm-hmm.
To celebrate the 640 CE victory over the Saxons by King Caldwallader, Welshmen sometimes wear the stem of a leek through their buttonholes on St. David's Day.
Okay.
And the legend goes this is because soldiers wore leeks around their hats to differentiate themselves in this battle.
Okay.
Yeah. In 1985, leeks were featured on the £1 coin in Wales. Again, please write in.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh my gosh. When it comes to the history of the scallion pancake, the date is also debated, but it's generally agreed that they are very old. There are a lot of legends about the origins, as with most things we talk about. Most of these legends put the scallion pancake coming out of Shanghai, which has some credence since it is a large city with a diverse population, including a decent amount of folks from India at one time. And some have pointed out the resemblance of the scallion pancake to the paratha or naan, Indian flatbreads like that. Marco Polo allegedly, allegedly, was a huge fan of scallion pancakes, so much so that he tried to recreate them upon returning home to Italy. And perhaps this was the precursor to the whole, we think pizza comes from Italy, but it actually comes from China story.
Ah.
Yeah, yeah. You can see our pizza episode for more on that one.
Yeah, right.
More likely it's a fun but not true story, but hey, mystery's history. According to John Young Phillips, host of the podcast Let's Find Out, and Edmonton's historian laureate, the scallion pancake was popularized in Edmonton, Canada in the 1980s, which is not a thing I knew we were going to come across in this research, but apparently it's really popular there and sort of an anomaly when compared to the rest of Canada. When investigating why, Phillips kept encountering the name Su Tou. Tou had moved to Canada from Shanghai, and he opened his first restaurant in 1978 and later a second one, Happy Garden and Mongolian Food Experience. They were the few, if not only, restaurants to offer scallion pancakes, and these pancakes were an immediate hit. Chinese and Taiwanese workers and students in Edmonton found them comforting and nostalgic, and word spread, especially once scallion pancakes appeared at food festivals like Taste of Edmonton, solidifying the food's status as a staple in Edmonton. And when you think about it, they totally lend themselves to food festivals. They're convenient, they're easily transportable, they're not super messy. They smell delicious. They taste delicious. They were so popular, Tou was able to sell his product at other restaurants. And he actually posted a video about it because some people were curious as to why restaurants just didn't start making them. And he was saying that the work involved in the way of deep frying that he did it was not worth it to a lot of places.
Sure.
Which is someone who's deep fried stuff. I see. I understand. I love scallion pancakes. I used to eat those several times a week when I was in China. Ugh.
It is definitely a thing that I cheat on my probably should not have onions rule with when I run across them in various restaurants.
Mm. Yes. And those calcets we mentioned earlier, okay, they are also shrouded in legend, as is pretty much everything in this episode. But most people date them to the beginning of the 20th century, or maybe the end of the 19th century. So the story goes that a local farmer wanting to preserve those white parts of scallions of calcets did this purposefully using a technique called calcar, which means both to cover the trunk of a plant with soil and to put one's shoes on, which I'm really delighted by. Other stories suggest impoverished farmers replanted their onions in hopes of a second harvest, and this would lead to an abundance that, of course, called for a feast.
Of course.
Obviously. The EU granted the calcet from Vi's protected geographical indication, so
that's great.
I know. Also, I'm not going to talk about this medical report I found, but I'll tell you, I found a medical report about the spring onion. Don't worry. You don't have to worry about it. You're fine. But very disturbing food research.
I will say that you should only use food items as food items. Do not apply them to other parts of your body.
Yes.
And here, at this point, I have to take us on a deep tangent. But I guess a lot of this episode has just been deep tangents, so that's okay. So in 1996, with the first Pokemon game released in Japan, players could obtain a Pokemon called Kamonegi. And this is a duck carrying like a scallion or a leek. Kamo being a word for duck, and negi being a word for those A, fistulosum scallions, which is sometimes translated into English as leek, because some varieties in Japan have been developed to be bigger, resembling and being used more like leeks than like scallions. And apparently this poke dude comes from a Japanese proverb that goes, kamo ga negi o tottekuru, which means like literally a duck comes along carrying a leek on its back, which apparently intonates like unexpected good luck. Like a duck just walks up to you. Cool, that's delicious. But it's carrying the thing that it's extra delicious with on its back. Yeah. So unexpected good luck. Like, heck yeah. the idiom is apparently sometimes shorted to kamonegi in everyday usage. So if anyone who's ever played or watched or read Pokemon was ever wondering where that duck carrying a green onion came from, there you go. There you go. Yeah. It's called Farfetch'd in American versions of the property. So,
wow. I have to say, Lauren kind of hinted at there would be a Pokemon tangent in this episode, and I've been wondering and wondering what it could be, and it delivered. Also, I'm extremely innocent because I was like, oh, the good luck is now you have leeks.
No.
Consider you're also going to eat the duck. I see now. I see.
It's a whole package. Yeah, there's apparently a popular duck soup in Japan is made with leeks. So,
now I know. Again, so much I have learned on this journey. And I'm a big fan of Pokemon facts. I think we should put them in every episode, anywhere we can.
You know, anytime I get a chance to, I'll help you out. We'll have our Pokemon tangent.
Yes. Thank you, Lauren. I knew I could count on you. Huh. I guess that's about what we have to say on scallions and green onions and some other things.
It is. We do have some listener mail for you, but first we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
And we're back with listener. Oh, I don't know a lot about Pokemon. I wish I did. I wish I knew what kind of sound I should have made.
The only Pokemon property I have experience with is Pokemon Go, and I have the sound turned off on it because I don't like my electronics to really make noise. So I couldn't tell you. I feel like super producer Andrew could have helped us with that one. Yeah.
I know Pikachu and Mewtwo. I have a very vivid memory of trying to bond with my little brother and taking him to see the Pokemon movie. Uh-huh. And he was like a very never cried.
Okay.
And he cried his eyes out. Hi, little brother, if you're listening or not. When Mewtwo died. And I did not know what to do.
Wow.
I was like, oh, what have I done? I was trying to have a fun time together. What have I done?
Oh, wow. Huh. I wonder if that's like, because my generation, a lot of my dude friends say that the first movie that they cried at was Transformers, the movie. Oh. So I wonder if Pokemon is like that for
younger generation.
Yeah.
Huh. I'll have to. I very much doubt he would ever even admit that happened to me. But maybe I'll try to get to the bottom of it. Jane wrote, I've been a listener since the very early days of the Form of Food stuff. Thank you both for great food-related entertainment, always thoughtful research and reporting, and that imitable awkward charm, to borrow Lauren's phrase. Thank you.
Anytime.
Yes. I am a recent and exceedingly glad ex-lawyer turned writer. Your podcast got me through literally years of suffering in corporate law before I finally chucked in the proverbial golden handcuffs and did what I've always wanted to. These days, Your stories form delightful accompaniments to a variety of home cooking adventures in quarantine. I love how the show both deepens my relationship with foods I already know and love and encourages me to try new things. The Salisbury steak episode in particular sent me on a multi-week, multi-recipe quest to reproduce the perfect version of my favorite college dining hall food that I hadn't thought about for almost a decade. My husband and I would have made Dr. Salisbury proud that month. As a fellow Francophile and lover of interesting etymologies, I had to hop on it when Annie asked for listener input about the mysterious origins of the name Roquefort. If you haven't already, I thought you guys would be interested to hear that the fascinating, sadly fading Occitan language may be involved. Ooh. The Roquefort area is very close to the medieval castle town of Roquemaure, for which eminent 20th century French etymologist Ernest Negre suggests an Occitan word as the likeliest origin. Roque, from Occitan roca, or rock, so Roquemaure means black rock. And as Annie pointed out, for, indeed, means strong. And this holds true whether in modern French, old Occitan, or Latin, from which both the former two derive. So it's likely that nearby Roquefort comes from an Occitan place name for strong rock. Given the limestone-dominated regional landscapes you describe, this would make a lot of sense. Alas, I do not actually have access to Negre's book, so I can't actually check if he has a distinct entry for Roquefort. But the shared Occitan origin does seem a very likely theory to me, especially as both Roquefort and Roquemaure are smack in the middle of what was once Occitan France. Hope you guys enjoyed this foray into arcane speculative etymology. Yes, always.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Please, y'all, write in with etymology notes. Also, congratulations on your career switch. Being a writer is a sometimes frustrating, but overall wonderful field.
Yes. Yes. Congrats on that. And yeah, thank you so much for going on this etymology adventure and sharing it with us.
Yeah. Rose wrote, so I was listening to your throwback on sourdough. It reminded me of when I first listened to it when it originally aired back in 2017. Little did I know that in 3 years, I would be babying my own sourdough pet. This quarantine has brought out the artisanal baker in so many, as well as myself, although artisanal not so much. I was first intrigued by a video I saw on Facebook on how to start your own sourdough starter and thought, I never thought of that. All I had on hand was all-purpose bleached and enriched flour, so I gave it a go. I mixed my 1-to-1 ratio of flour and water and set it on the counter until it was time to feed it 24 hours later. Once it came time to feed it, it had a light sour smell, but not too strong. Fast forward it to 6 days later, and nothing was happening. I thought I had done something wrong because there were small bubbles on the surface, but it wasn't rising, and the hooch, the clear liquid, had separated and was sitting on top. I decided to dump it and go on a quest to find organic, unbleached flour after many articles and videos later told me that organic unbleached was the best since most of the yeasts naturally living on the wheat weren't killed off in the bleaching process. Once I miraculously found my organic unbleached flour, I tried it again. I measured out my equal parts water and flour, mixed and poured into a mason jar, and only covered it with the flat lid, not the ring, so that it could breathe and expel its gases. I kept going, discarding and feeding it the 1-to-1-to-1 ratio of starter, flour, and water, and 3 days later, lo and behold, it rose and had lots of bubbles. But, alas, my joy and feeling of accomplishment was short-lived, because it went flat and lifeless on day 4, and the layer of hooch was back. I consulted with many expert sourdough bakers in a group, and I was advised to just leave it be, keep feeding, and the day will come when it's matured. I was patient, and then, on day 14 after a feeding, it was rising! It was alive! So, now I had a sourdough starter. It was a couple of weeks until I mustered up the courage to make something with my starter. My first sourdough baked good was the good old sourdough English muffin. They were delicious! After that, I just fed my starter and made pancakes or crumpets with the discard, which, by the way, are also delicious. Temperature and region has much to do with how fast or slow your starter will mature and how many times a day you'll need to feed it. I live in SoCal, and it's warmer, so my starter gets hungry more often. No starter is the same. Like all living things, they have their own personalities and needs. The suggested feeding ratio is 1:1:1 of starter, flour, and water, but it can vary depending on what your starter needs. I tend to feed mine 1:2:2, starter, flour, and water. Baking sourdough takes time. Unlike with instant yeast you get at the store, it will not rise in an hour or two, and some recipes for artisanal loaves call for kneading every hour for X amount of hours, and then they have to rise for 8 to 10 hours. Sourdough takes its time to rise. I haven't gotten into the artisanal loaf baking, but I do bake my 2 sandwich loaves every week. And they take about 15 hours from start to finish. Still want to try it out? By the way, if you want a different flavor in your baked goods, add sugar when you feed your starter. It creates those sugar alcohols that give your bread a malty flavor. I'd like to also add that sourdough baking can get even more complicated with hydration percentage and the folding and kneading techniques, what kind of baskets you're proofing your dough in, to what kind of vessel you'll be baking it in, such as a Dutch oven or clay pot. It's all very exhausting, really, and I can go on and on, even more than I already did. In the end, it is so much fun and rewarding to get to eat the fruits of your labor. Try it out. You'll love it, but also do your research.
I love this so much. I love hearing people legitimately talk about these starters like pets. Like they have different personalities and different needs.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you need to feed it more often.
You have to listen to it and see what. Yeah, no, it's all true though. That's I'm so glad that you finally figured out your starter's personality
and needs. And, yeah.
Yes.
Yes. And everything you're making sounds delicious.
Yes.
Very jealous. I have not started mine yet. I will, even though you did give me a lot more things to consider. because it turns out I don't have any flour.
Oh.
Who
that
knew?
Could put a crimp in it. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I need to acquire some things first, but sure. I'll get there. And yes, to all the listeners sending in your sourdoughs and their names and what's going on, what you're making, keep that up.
Yeah, please.
It's lovely. Oh. And thanks to both of them for writing. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @SaverPod. And we do hope to hear from you. Savor is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Thanks, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.